Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Joe Biden's visit to Kenosha, Wisconsin today, and his meeting with the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot 7 times in the back at close range by a Kenosha police officer, sparking protests. Biden's visit follows Trump's recent meeting with local Kenosha police officials, and we'll discuss the contrast between supporting the victims of racial violence and the perpetrators, and whether Trump's strategy of division and fear will be more effective with the electorate than Biden's strategy of hope and healing. Ali Hochschild, one of the most influential American sociologists who has studied Trump voters and why they support him, and is the author of Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right, joins us to discuss her article at The Guardian, The Secret to Donald Trump's Electoral Strategy, Emotion, Not Policy. She joins us to discuss how Trump offers simplistic strongman magic to his white, fearful, resentful, and humiliated base, while Biden faces the challenge of showing that real strength does not depend on magic. Then we'll speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist James Risen, who is the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times. He joins us to discuss his latest article at The Intercept, Senate Report Shows What Mueller Missed About Trump and Russia. We'll look into how the almost 1,000-page Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee report puts the Mueller report to shame, and if anybody reads it, it brings the Trump-Russia story to life, leaving no doubt about how deeply and dangerously Trump is dependent on and is compromised by Putin. Then finally, we will speak with Kai Strittmatter, who was the China correspondent for Germany's national newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, for more than a decade and has studied China for more than 30 years. He joins us to discuss his new book, We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State, and how China, under Xi Jinping, is becoming an Orwellian nightmare of digital authoritarianism, with citizens' loyalty to the regime ranked by a social credit system, and with a new digital currency being introduced, the lives and finances of the Chinese will be tracked even more closely. And before we go to our first guest, I want to thank you, our listeners and supporters, who have donated to sustain and build Background Briefing as the radio station we broadcast from closes down and we transition to online broadcasting, particularly during this pandemic. Your donations will help us improve our recording capabilities from home, so we encourage you to throw us a lifeline and join the fact-based community of listeners we are building around the globe with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate, which helps keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to all those who are not in a position to contribute. And joining us now is Ali Hochschild, who is one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages, the winner of the Ulysses Medal, and 5 honorary degrees, as well as the Guggenheim and Mellon Grants. Her latest book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And she has an article at The Guardian, The Secret to Donald Trump's Electoral Strategy, Emotion, Not Policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Hochschild.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ali. And Vice President Biden visited Kenosha, Wisconsin today and met with the family of Jacob Blake, who was shot 7 times in the back at close range by a Kenosha police officer. In contrast, Donald Trump was there recently. He met with the police officers and actually supported a young pro-Trump vigilante who shot dead a couple of Black Lives Matter protesters. So in terms of what you're arguing in your piece in The Guardian, that Trump offers simplistic strongman magic to his white, fearful, resentful, and humiliated base, while Biden faces the challenge of showing that real strength does not depend on magic. So is this a contest between fear and hope?
Yes, I think that's a good way of boiling it down. I think actually that Biden has a job to do, because if we look at the polls, people want order, okay? And if we look at the polls, black and white want law. You know, they want the lawmakers they elect to pass laws. What they don't want is police brutality, don't want looting. So for Biden to win, his job is not to wave a magic wand the way Trump is doing, but to say, I stand with the victims of police brutality, and also for order. And so, you know, there are those that say that's a right-wing desire, law and order, but that's not what the polls say. And so Biden has to say, you can be good and also be for law and order. In fact, it's proper law and proper order that the Black Lives Matter people are struggling to get.
So when you suggest that goodness could be Biden's weapon, what Yes. about that old adage that nice guys finish last? Have we become that cynical in this country? Because everything about Trump is pretty cynical. The people around him, many of them are in jail. They're a pretty sleazy bunch. It is, seems to be a very cynical moment, and much of his appeal is quite cynical, suggesting that people who have empathy are sort of weak, whereas he's a strong man.
That's right. And actually, his call for law and order is completely cynical. If we look at what he's done, he dashes off reckless go-get-em tweets. He compares shooting with golf strokes. Seven of his closest advisors, Cohen, Flynn, Manafort, Papadopoulos, Gates, Stone, now Bannon, have all been indicted for breaking the law. So how can he be the law and order guy? It's magical. He seems to, in a way, use reality as if it's a stage prop. I think what I'm arguing about Trump, and then I'll come to the goodness part, I think Trump is, people say, well, look, he's so incoherent, he doesn't have a strategy. But they're looking for logic. No, he doesn't have a logical strategy. But or they say he's delusional, right? Irrational. I don't think that either. I think he's using illusions. He's like an illusionist in a very canny way, appealing to people's fear and actually trying to lift up a kind of a depressed part of this country, many of whom are high school educated whites. And he's masterful at kind of appealing to this group. And if we look at white high school educated men, that's about a third of the country, and that's his target group. But so is goodness, do a good guy's finish last? No, I don't think so. If you look at Nelson Mandela, if you look at Mahatma Gandhi, it's goodness that they lift from people and guide with it in a morally powerful way. I think there are two kinds of power, and over the long haul, sheer force, such as Trump in a second term would not hesitate to use, yields a frightening but brittle power. But I think the legitimacy of compassion leads to a more difficult to achieve but more lasting and resilient power. So, that's what I'd say.
Well, but Ali Hochschild, there's no question that you were describing the Republican convention. It was full of that sort of magical idea. Everything is great. COVID-19 has gone away. In any other country, a president or a leader who had performed as badly and irresponsibly and incompetently as Donald Trump has, they would have already asked for his resignation. He'd be already out of office now. What explains the hold that he has, that he can still stay in power and somehow manage to tell this alternative reality about how great things are, I mean, we are the rest of the world is starting to, at least our allies are starting to feel sorry for us.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think we have to back up and, you know, to the 1970s to take a long look at what globalization has done to local economies. It's dislocated them, and it's created winners and losers. And a lot of the red states are in loser states. They're Rust Belt towns, either urban or rural versions of them, that have lost, and they feel displaced. They feel vulnerable. And I think he is posing himself as their rescuer, and they don't see anything else around for them. So I think that's not just happening in the United States. We're seeing it in India. We're seeing it in the Philippines. We're seeing it in Russia. We're seeing it in Poland, Hungary, Austria. I mean, there is a move toward a strong man, autocratic rule, and it is, they are often using the promise of rescue and dangling that out to the losers of globalization. So I think that's the background, and that's not mysterious. And we've seen autocrats arise locally before, especially in the 1920s. So, but this puts a lot of pressure on Vice President Biden, who represents, in my view, sanity and humanity, and he needs to add to it, I think, a special appeal to Trump's base, and that is this displaced white high school educated male, and to say, look, there are jobs for you. I mean, this is, in fact, Biden's call, but to have a Rebuild America Corps, for example, that such people could join. And it wouldn't be just whites that this would appeal to, but to those who are anxious about their livelihood and their way of life. So to combine that with the promise of decency, this could be a very powerful call.
Well, indeed, with interest rates almost at zero, a huge infrastructure program to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure would seem to be obvious. I haven't noticed that one on the agenda. But
right.
But just in closing, is there also, when you contrast the Republican convention with all of its sort of glitz and glory and glorification and grandiosity, compared to the very diverse, multiracial display of the Democrats, is there inherently a problem in the sense that the white party of the Republicans is feeling good because they have every reason to feel good? They're doing okay, and particularly the plutocrats who Trump really has taken care of, they're doing great. Whereas on the other side, on the Democratic side, the minority communities in this country, you know, they're still wanting justice and still wanting equity. So therefore, they appear to be complaining while the other people are celebrating. Is that a subconscious kind of message?
Yes, I think you've put your finger on something very important. And there are really two things. One is Biden looks like he's part of a whole diverse committee. He's having to pull together groups, multiple groups, whereas Trump appears in one place with one family and one party, you know, in front of one podium. He looks more unified. So I think Biden has to be like the ringleader in a circus, you know, and that's the model of leadership that we need to look to him for. And as for having something to complain about, he could say, yes, there is something to complain about, and we need to have the heart and the soul and the American kind of identity to address those grievances. That's who we are. He's right to say this is a battle for the soul of America. And I hope he wins.
Well, I do too, and I think a lot of Americans, in fact, the majority of Americans do. But
yeah.
We're up against criminality, we're up against Putin, we're up against all kinds of, and an attorney general who thinks that mail-in votings are rife with fraud, etc. So we have quite a struggle ahead. I thank you for joining us, Ali Hochschild.
Good. And register to vote and get your votes in early.
Yeah. Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ali Hochschild, who's one of the most influential sociologists of her generation. She's the author of 9 books, including The Second Shift, The Time Bind, The Managed Heart, and The Outsourced Self. 3 of her books have been named as New York Times Notable Books of the Year, and her work appears in 16 languages. The winner of the Ulysses Medal and 5 honorary degrees, as well as a Guggenheim and Mellon Grants. Her latest book is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning on the American Right. And she has an article at The Guardian, The Secret to Donald Trump's Electoral Strategy, Emotion, Not Policy. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter James Risen about how the Republican-led Senate Intelligence Committee report puts the Mueller report to shame. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War, among other books. In 2006, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Senate Report Shows What Mueller Missed About Trump and Russia. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Risen.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And just to touch on your book about the warrantless wiretapping, for which you won the Pulitzer, it's interesting that the Ninth Circuit here in California basically are exonerating Edward Snowden in their ruling that the FISA process was violated and unconstitutional in terms of scooping up all that data on American citizens.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a lot of court challenges the program began right after 9/11. It was started by the Bush administration and then expanded under Obama. And there's been a lot of legal challenges. And one of the reason the government has usually won these cases is because of what they call standing. It's hard to get somebody who can prove that that their privacy was invaded by the program because it's secret and nobody knows whether their rights were violated because the government refuses to provide any real data about individuals who've been spied upon. And since the courts can't get access to that information, they've repeatedly overturned legal challenges by saying, you know, you can't prove you have standing to sue the government on this. And so it's good if there's finally some legal challenges that will work.
So let's turn to your article, Senate Report Shows What Mueller Missed About Trump and Russia. And this almost 1,000-page report that came out a few weeks ago you basically argue puts the Mueller report to shame.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it's really too bad this report came out right as the Democratic convention was starting, and it got a few headlines the first day, but I don't even think most of the reporters who wrote about it read the whole thing, because it took me like a week to read it. It's about 970 pages. It is one of the most remarkable reports I've ever read from Congress, because it's bipartisan. It was, you know, produced by a Republican-controlled committee. You know, you might expect it to be some whitewash for Trump, but in fact, it is devastating for Trump, and it really shows what Mueller missed and all the connections and the relationships that Mueller didn't look at, because he had this very narrow legalistic approach about whether he could prove criminal charges against individuals. And it's fascinating, because this report actually criticizes Mueller for that approach and for not looking at the bigger picture of all the connections between the Trump people and the Russians and the Ukrainians. And I really recommend all Americans to read this, because it's the one report on Trump and Russia that I think people should read.
And of course, we're learning from Michael Schmidt's new book that it was Rod Rosenstein who shut down the counterintelligence investigation that began when Trump fired Comey, but he never told the FBI. Yeah. he shut it down, that he did it in secret. And he told Mueller when he gave him his writ, saying, you just have to pursue the criminal charges and don't go anywhere near counterintelligence. And counterintelligence is where the real story is. And that's what the Senate report makes clear.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's the original sin of the Mueller investigation Mueller went along with that. And Mueller had a very linear approach to this, in the sense that he ignored things that, you know, he couldn't use in a criminal case. And this was really not a traditional criminal case. It was a covert action by a foreign government in which they got some collaboration with the Trump campaign. And that is very difficult to frame that in a criminal context. That's one thing that I really appreciated about this report. It goes back to Trump's earliest interactions with the Russians, and goes forward to look at all his business connections, his personal connections, and then all of the connections of all the people around him, including like the NRA and the, and this is the first that I've seen where it really like puts a lot of these various cases that we've heard about over the last few years into the proper context, like Maria Butina and the whole, her Russian, her acting as a Russian agent. You really begin to connect the dots in a way that no one else has done. The other thing I was just going to say is that the thing that I think is really refreshing about this is that it also it debunks some of the things that had been proven to be wrong, things like the Steele dossier, and it points out some of the FBI's mistakes in their handling of the investigation. You know, things that Trump and his minions have focused on. And by doing that in a bipartisan way, you're able to read this report and kind of judge for yourself, you know, the relative significance of all of the various things that we've heard about the Trump and Russia. And you come away from this report thinking, sure, there were flaws in the investigation, but that overall, There is no doubt that the Russians intervened in the 2016 campaign to help Trump win, and that Trump and his campaign did everything they could to cooperate and collaborate with the Russians.
Well, to this day, the mystery continues. I mean, why has Trump not said or done anything about reports that the Russians were paying the Taliban bounties to kill Americans? Why has he not done
right.
anything about the Russian fighter flying right in front of a B-52, causing tremendous turbulence, and the Russians in Syria ramming their vehicles into American vehicles, injuring seven Americans? And then now the
right.
poisoning of Navalny, the opposition
right.
leader, by Novichok, the nerve agent that was
right.
used against the Skripals. So this is all very flagrant, and we don't hear a peep out of Trump. But what I think
right.
this report does, James, is it absolutely makes what Barr and John Durham are up to, investigating the investigators, ridiculous. It's a joke. I mean, everything
yes.
in this report absolutely nails the very stuff that Barr and Durham are trying to undo.
Right. Yes. And I think that's the thing that I appreciated. One of the things I appreciated about this report, it shows, for instance, yeah, there were problems with the FISA application for Carter Page. Yes, you know, the FBI didn't notify the Clinton campaign early enough or aggressively enough about the hack. And yes, they kind of made mistakes as they went along, as they tried to begin this investigation. And they spent too much time, you know, looking and thinking about the Steele dossier. And but all of those things, as you read this report, the overwhelming evidence of Russian involvement and Trump and his supporters' efforts to work with the Russians just overwhelms those problems. And you come away thinking, you know, as I said, this was a somewhat flawed investigation, as almost every criminal investigation is, or every counterintelligence investigation is, but that the central story is true, that the Russians intervened to help Trump win, and Trump was happy to embrace their help.
And again, I'm speaking with James Risen, the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept, and he has an article at The Intercept, Senate Report Shows What Mueller Missed About Trump and Russia. One of the interesting aspects of the report, it's around page 640, James, is what was going on in Russia with David Giovannis, who's still working for the Russians, and for Deripaska, along with Leon Black. And Leon Black, of course, along with the Secretary of Treasury, Mnuchin, are proteges of Michael Milken, who's just bought, I think it's the Hay Adams, isn't it, right across from the White House to set up the Milken
Oh,
Institute.
I didn't know that, yeah.
Yeah. So there's that. But these guys are called in the business white boys. They're hired by crooked oligarchs and billionaires and kleptocrats around the world to give them respectability. They, you know, Harvard, Wharton business grads come out of these white shoe law firms like Akin Gump and
right.
Kirkland and Ellis. And what happened in November of 96 is interesting. The Leon Black and David Giovannis, who again is still operating in Moscow, I guess, I don't know, laundering Deripaska's money or giving him respectability. That's a fascinating story, isn't it? How November 96,
yeah.
Trump shows up with Miss Moscow and then shows up in a meeting with the mayor of Moscow with a couple of young hookers he spent the night with. Amazing
right.
stuff.
Right. Yeah, I think that was one of the things that I thought was really important was, you know, the people, it's been easy for Trump has been focusing on the mistakes made in the Steele dossier or the stories that don't quite pan out as a way to discredit the whole story. So, for instance, the whole idea that there's some video out there showing two women urinating on his hotel bedroom, a bed in his room, because he thinks this is where Obama once slept, he was able to say, see, this shows everything is a hoax. But what the Senate report shows is they both debunk the Steele dossier and then say, yeah, but here's the truth. Trump did, almost certainly did have, or they say that he may have had an affair with a young Russian woman who they don't name in 1996, who was introduced to him through at a party hosted by some of the people you just were discussing, and that the Russians almost certainly knew about it. Now, is that to me sounds so much more plausible than the so-called P-tape. And it's one of the things that one of the virtues of this report, I think, is that it doesn't pull punches on either side. It says, look, you know, that other story from the Steele dossier is ridiculous, but that doesn't mean that Trump couldn't, you know, wasn't having affairs with young Russian women at a time when the Russians knew about it. And it doesn't mean that that couldn't provide some counterintelligence threat.
Sure. And the Russians are dangling the Trump Tower in front of him. They've been dangling that since 1987 when he made his first trip to Moscow with his wife, Ivana, acting as his translator. They dangled the Trump Tower then. So that's been the lure, hasn't it, all along? And in fact, it continued through 2017 with Michael Cohen and Felix Sater trying to set the deal up still.
I think you could make an argument. There are people who have argued, and you know, I can't prove this, obviously, but there are a number of people who wonder how much of trips to Moscow, how much of his interest in traveling to Moscow was about business versus women. There's probably both. So,
as Putin said recently,
because he never developed a business deal there, despite his, you know, his travels there on and off, and but he did seem to get women. So,
I was going to say, James, that Putin recently bragged that we have the best prostitutes in the world. So, there you have it. Donald Trump is an easy mark. Right. What about, though, one of the chapters in the Senate Intelligence Report? Again, it's a Republican-led committee, and very, very pro-Trump Republicans like Tom Cotton and Cornyn signed off on it. So it's pretty extraordinary that they let this information out. But the activities of the Israeli cyber intelligence company, Psy Group, is so interesting. And again, this pantheon of sleazy characters like George Nader, who hired this company, this Israeli company, on behalf of MBZ of the Emirates. And they also, I think, work with MBS. And of course, George Nader is a convicted child molester who's in jail as we speak. Perhaps he's squealing. I don't know. What do you make of that? You know, because the people.
Well, I think that, you know, you've raised a really important point that as you read, as I read this, and as I said, I tried to read almost. I think I read the entire thing, and you read this and you want to take a shower after you read about all of the characters around Donald Trump, because as you said, there is just one sleazebag after another. He surrounds himself, and he has to this day with creeps and sleazebags and questionable people with questionable integrity. I mean, I guess he's a magnet for that because of who he is and what he is. And it's just an amazing assortment of bad actors who, you know, it reminds me, and I know nobody likes this comparison, but it reminds me a lot of Hitler and of the early days of the Nazi Party when, you know, they were hanging around the beer halls in Munich, and it was just a bunch of losers who hung around Hitler and psychopaths, and suddenly they're in power. And that's what I think, that, you know, was around Trump, an assortment of losers and psychopaths and criminals, and suddenly he's in power.
Well, the Times of Israel's reporting on the Psi group that were involved, and the Senate Intelligence Committee report doesn't conclude that they helped Trump get elected, but they were working with the Russians, which is pretty extraordinary in itself.
And yeah, and there's and the Cambridge Analytica and
Cult Ventures, right? So,
yeah, I mean, there's just a whole bunch of them, and then. Black Cube was kind of on the fringes of it as well, and the interesting thing is, you know, what really was the role of these analytical companies, or the you know the Psi group, which you know does psychological operations, or some of these other groups in terms of you know, like Manafort had this whole background in disinformation. So, I mean, there's a whole cadre of disinformation experts and analytical experts who have been attracted to this weird, into this weird orbit.
So just in closing, we know that Russia's actively involved in the 2020 elections. And if it's close, they could tip the scales, at the very least create chaos, because at the end of the day, Putin has it covered. Back in 2016, if Trump would have lost, as Putin expected and everybody else expected, Trump would be running around the country leading rallies against Hillary Clinton to diminish her ability to govern by leading the cry of the chant of lock her up, lock her up. This time around, is it possible that other players who are highly motivated, arguably people like Benjamin Netanyahu, MBS and MBZ, are even more motivated to get Trump reelected? The last thing they want is Joe Biden. He's going to totally. Yeah. So given the activities of Psy Group revealed in the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Israeli cyber spy group, do you think there's any chance that these other players like Netanyahu, MBS, and MBZ behind the scenes? Because after all, hacking into Jeff Bezos's phone is just the tip of an iceberg of what their capabilities are.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they're all working to some degree. I don't know that they have the capabilities of the GRU or to manipulate things like Facebook. That, to me, is the biggest issue in terms of digital threat right now is social media and manipulating social media. But I think you're right. I think they all could be involved. They all have similar motives. Netanyahu, I think there is a kind of a white identity coalition, international coalition that's kind of coalescing around Trump and Putin.
Well, James Risen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with James Risen, who is the senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times and author of the New York Times bestseller State of War. In 2006, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his stories about warrantless wiretapping by the NSA. And in 2007, he was elected into the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. And his latest book is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. And he has an article at The Intercept, Senate Report Shows What Mueller Missed About Trump and Russia. Going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a veteran correspondent who spent 30 years studying China about the Orwellian nightmare of China today, where citizens' loyalty to the regime are ranked by a social credit system, and with a new digital currency being introduced, the lives of the Chinese and their finances will be tracked even more closely.
Beware the savage, oh, 1965.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from Copenhagen in Denmark is Kai Strittmatter, who was the China correspondent for Germany's national newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, for more than a decade. He is fluent in Mandarin and has studied China for more than 30 years. And his latest book just out is We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. Welcome to Background Briefing, Kai Strittmatter.
Hello, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us, Kai. And it's a little bit ironic that just yesterday, 7 years after the former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden revealed the mass surveillance program here in the United States, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit handed down a verdict saying that the warrantless telephone scooping up of all that data on millions of Americans violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and may have been unconstitutional. Very different to what's happening in China, right? China is just marching ahead in towards this kind of Orwellian, I guess what you call a digital authoritarian state.
Exactly. I mean, it is ironic with the Edward Snowden thing. I get this very often when I do talks that people come up to me and say, but aren't we just the same? Isn't the United States just doing the same? And I always say, no, it's still a huge difference whether you have a democracy sometimes stepping over its borders or a dictatorship like China, because there still is separation of power and clearly judiciary is still working in the United States. Whereas in China, what we're seeing is actually what I would call a return of totalitarianism.
Well, it's a much more efficient form of totalitarianism, arguably. And for all of the techno-utopian dreams of the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, how the internet is going to free us and become this amazing tool for education and information, it's the dark side is clearly what's happening in China, right? It's become a tool of repression.
Yes, that's the interesting thing, that we've had so many prophets, tech prophets in the West telling us that all new technologies, I mean, starting with the mobile phone, satellite TV, then the internet, all those technologies were supposed to bring freedom even to the last dark corner to the planet and to subvert authoritarian regimes. And suddenly now in China, we have this stage which shows us actually the opposite is true. You know, the regime there not only has lost its fear of those technologies, on the opposite, it has learned to love them and taken them in as the best instruments for actually perfecting its control.
Well, let's since you spent so much time in China and know the language and know the people and know this regime in particular, Xi Jinping, of course, has declared himself a leader for life. My sense is that, you know, there was a recent report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence here saying that China wanted Joe Biden. They didn't say that they preferred Donald Trump because they work for Donald Trump and they're basically loyalists, not real intelligence people. But nevertheless, they suggested that China wanted Joe Biden because they didn't like the instability and unpredictability of Trump. My sense is that the opposite is true, that Donald Trump has been the gift that keeps on giving to the Chinese, starting with the first thing that he did when he became president, which was to cancel the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Is there an explanation for the extraordinary consolidation of power in terms of this new sort of Mao Zedong regime that Xi Jinping has put together, where he's absolutely captured control? How much has it been aided and abetted by the lack of an international coordinated response? Because the TPP was not so much a trade deal as the idea to organize the neighborhood to force China to play by international rules. And of course, China is making its own rules now.
I'm with you on that one. You're exactly right. The TPP was the first huge strategic mistake that Donald Trump actually did. And this is one of the big problems with him. And I also think you're right that actually, at least until a couple of weeks ago and months ago, the Chinese actually were hoping for Trump's re-election, because he is actually actively weakening and destroying the Western alliance and also the strength of the United States. You know, he says, make America great again. What he does actually for any outside observer is quite clear. He's making America weaker. And certainly in the eyes of the Chinese, he's doing this. And I think really Xi Jinping is quite glad that he had an opponent like Donald Trump exactly during the time when he took office and later tried to actually establish a quite new form of control in China, one that goes back on the one hand to the old repression, which we haven't seen in China for 30, 40 years. This is really something, the China we're seeing at the moment is not the China we grew up with and we got used to. It's not the China of reform and opening anymore. It's as repressive as it hasn't been since the days of Mao Zedong. And at the same time, the strengthening of this regime with these high-tech information age digital tools. I think the Chinese were very, very glad with Donald Trump actually pulling the United States out of international organizations and giving actually China's new ambitions a lot of room and space.
But it seems to me, Kai, that it's even worse than that, in the sense that the irony is, of course, that the coronavirus began in China, in Wuhan, but the Chinese were very quick in containing it, yet it spread around the world. And the country that has been most impacted has been the United States. We have over 6 million infections, about close to 190,000 deaths. And we are an economic basket case. There's no sense of when the economy is going to open up again, maybe a year's time. In effect, the economy is in free fall and unemployment is rising and businesses are going bankrupt. Meanwhile, other countries like China are back up and running. So as the global hegemon, we could basically become the world's basket case because of Trump's mishandling. I know the Chinese probably cannot believe how badly Trump has handled it. But do you see this situation, when you talked about the United States as being weakened, isn't the pandemic weakening it to an alarming degree, largely because of Trump's mishandling?
I think you're right. The United States is weakened. I'm not sure whether the pandemic has weakened it more or whether the pandemic is just one, you know, symbol of the failures and one outcome, actually, rather than a cause of the weakening. Because, I mean, really, yeah, what a difference a few months make. A couple of months ago in February, when I was talking and writing about the coronavirus and looking at what was happening in China, I actually spoke of system failure, and I saw it as a real example of how this dictatorship that, you know, with its concentration of power and its lack of critical voices, how it has actually made itself blind for realities in the country, which led to the outbreak. And in the beginning, they were keeping it secret, and it became worse and worse. And for 6, 7, 8 weeks, it was a complete system failure in China, until the top guard realized what was happening, and then they made a 180-degree turn and did the harshest measures imaginable, unimaginable in our countries. And they were trying very, very soon to tell their people, actually, you see, we got control back. We are doing the best for your safety and for your health. And we are, and actually our system is the best in dealing with this. And this, the whole coronavirus crisis, shows the superiority of the Chinese system, which of course is a joke. It's a complete joke. If you look at China, at what has happened in December and January there, but their narrative, of course, was helped by the outside world. First, they could point the finger to Italy and Spain, where there was a little bit of chaos. And then, even better, the United States descended really in this state of chaos, and obvious to the outside world that there is no leadership, that there is an erratic president who doesn't believe in science. I mean, you know, this is a big difference to the Chinese leaders. One thing you can say about them is they do believe in science. And on the other side, you have Donald Trump. You have so many more deaths in the United States, at least as the official count is in China. And you have an economic, actually, disaster. Whilst China, at the same time, actually has regained its economic strength a little bit, and the exports have taken up. And so in the eyes of the Chinese people, actually, which have to listen to the propaganda of their rulers, that makes quite an impressive and effective case, them pointing to the United States and saying, you see, you're much safer here with us.
So let's talk about your new book, We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State, and how the Communist Party of the People's Republic of China controls 1.4 billion people. They obviously, we know how much they control the Uyghurs in the West, which has been described as the largest open-air prison in the world. They have this system of this social credit system, which ranks citizens' loyalty and dependability, which is totally Orwellian. But now I understand they're moving into a digital currency, which will control the people even more because it'll be able to track their finances, etc. So what is the glue that's holding the people together with this regime? Because we all remember Tiananmen and the aspiration for democracy with the young people building the symbol of democracy. And it seems that the Chinese leadership after Tiananmen decided to expunge any aspiration for democracy by encouraging nationalism and materialism. So what is Xi Jinping, who, by the way, I don't believe he even has a high school diploma. He's not a particularly bright person, from my understanding, but he's extremely effective and quite militant. I think his family comes out of the military, and that seems to be his favorite tool in many ways. So what's holding this regime together in terms of the loyalty of its people, even though they're oppressed? Is it because if you want to get ahead in China, you have to join the Communist Party? What's the glue?
As far as Xi Jinping is concerned, you're right. He couldn't make a high school degree when he was young, but that's not his fault. That was the Cultural Revolution in China. All the schools and universities were closed. And actually, later he has a university degree from Tsinghua University. But he is a very authoritarian character, and he's no new Mao Zedong. I wouldn't say that, because Mao was a very different type. Mao loved chaos, and he loved instability. If it helped him, if it suited him in his power games, Xi Jinping is a freak for stability and control. He wants to have complete and total control. And with regards to the people, you were right. Of course, one of the big pillars is economic success. You know, this is, you have to say, the party has delivered in the past decades. The urban elites, at least, they were becoming more wealthy year by year. And at the same time, for many years, they actually enjoyed more and more freedoms from year to year, a little bit more. They were carving out little niches of civil society and stuff. But that part, with that part, Xi Jinping has done away completely, because when he got to power in 2012, he saw the Communist Party was in a big crisis, and he thought the only means to save it was to get total and complete control back. So why do the people go along with it? Of course, for one, you know, to be against, openly against the regime would be suicidal in a state like China. But then at the same time, many people do enjoy actually the economic success, and they credit the party for that, because as we all know, all over the world, there are other dictatorships, kleptocratic regimes where the people don't have any benefits. So in China, the people do get some benefits. And then Xi Jinping has really strengthened this nationalist and militaristic brainwashing, really, even more than it was before. And he has given the Chinese people something that he calls the Chinese dream, or the China dream. Obviously, you know, borrowing the term of the American dream, but it means something completely different, because it's not about individual happiness. On the contrary, it's about the rise, the rebirth, actually, the renaissance of the great Chinese nation. China will be back, will come back, and it will retake its old place in the world, its old role as one of the biggest, if not the biggest world power. And that works as well, you know. I mean, we see it in Russia. Nationalism works. It's a very cheap, a very effective means with all autocratic rulers. And in Russia, people don't even get the material benefits that they do get in China. So it is quite effective if you have this balance, a balance of this brainwashing, propaganda, censorship, and then the means of control, like the high-tech control also. And also in the background, always this background noise of you know, all the means of terror and fear and repression. If you do not obey, if you dare to speak out. And the mixture of all this makes it actually quite effective and successful.
Well, what do you think, though, is going to happen in terms of the militarized sort of foreign policy of Xi Jinping, you know, picking a fight with the Indians on the border, taking over Hong Kong? Of course, you didn't hear a peep from President Trump. There's some rumors that he may try some military moves against Taiwan. I mean, in a geostrategic sense, the U.S. is still obsessed with Russia, even though Russia's ultimately a nuisance compared to China, which could be a real threat. And this wolf warrior diplomacy that Xi Jinping talked about, and of course the wolf warrior version of China's version of Rambo, is a kind of scary portent, isn't it? So could this rise in nationalism that Xi Jinping is stoking lead to some more military misadventures?
Yeah, so there's two things. There's the wolf warrior diplomacy, which is obviously part of the worldwide campaign of sort of, you know, they're trying to gain more influence worldwide. They're not necessarily, you know, they're not after world domination. I wouldn't say that, you know, they don't want to conquer and rule the world. But if you talk about military strategies, they definitely have very big and more aggressive interests in their own backyard, which would be, you were talking about, India, the Indian-Chinese border. There is Hong Kong, even though the Hong Kong issue is not so much a military issue. And there's the South China Sea and Taiwan, which are more on the military side. And that is something where the West also and the United States, where we really have interests, because a lot of the global trade, you know, a lot of the global container shipping goes through the South China Sea, and suddenly China saying basically the whole area is ours. That is quite unprecedented and quite dangerous. And I think the United States now, they are sending ships there as well to test out, to show the resolve of the United States. But you were right in pointing out Taiwan. Taiwan is a very delicate issue, because Taiwan is, in the eyes of the Chinese, it's the lost island that has to be reunited with the fatherland. It was lost in the civil war that Mao Zedong won, but his rival Chiang Kai-shek, he fled to Taiwan, and with the help of the Americans, Taiwan stayed a de facto independent country until today. So what I think is the dangerous thing, I don't think, you know, they're out for, they would have to be really stupid if they were seeking military aggression and conflict with the United States at the moment. They're not strong enough yet. But you can never exclude the possibility with all the militaristic, nationalistic propaganda. Actually, you know, one day the Communist Party is seeing itself cornered when the point arrives. And I think this will be a critical moment when domestically they reach a point when the economy doesn't run as well anymore, and when there will be not necessarily a breakdown or an implosion, but let's say stagnation, and they don't have enough money anymore to cover up all the internal, you know, there's so many problems inside of China. And when they feel pressured domestically, and when you have unrest here and unrest there suddenly, I think the big danger is that at that point, they will look for something on the outside, like Taiwan, to basically divert the attention and stoke up nationalistic feeling. And And the Taiwanese, actually, after I left China in 2018, I spent 4 weeks in Taiwan. I spoke to the foreign minister there. They're actually really afraid of that. And this is a real possibility for the midterm future.
Well, Kai Strittmatter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kai Strittmatter, who was the China correspondent for Germany's national newspaper, Süddeutsche Zeitung, for more than a decade and is fluent in Mandarin, having studied China for more than 30 years. And his latest book just out is We Have Been Harmonized, Life in China's Surveillance State. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for email updates, as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. To help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate free, we have added a donate button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved, standing along the side of the pickup truck. A shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right. Another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305 park and disappeared by 9:30. Who will ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me, an angel song about the home of the brave and this land here of the free. One time, one night. One more light goes on.